Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Tides of History early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts. Hi, everybody. From Wondery, welcome to another episode of Tides of History. I'm Patrick Wyman. Thanks for joining me. One of the things I've enjoyed most about diving into the more distant human past is the incredible variety of new methods that scholars are using to study these periods. Genetics is the one that comes to mind first, of course, in large part because the geneticists have gotten really good at getting journalists to write about their findings. But ancient DNA is just the tip of that particular iceberg. The one that seems most promising to me in the long run is stable isotope analysis, which can shed light on a whole bunch of different aspects of human experience, and in so doing, bring us much closer to the actual lives of people who lived and died a very, very long time ago. To help us understand more about the potential of this exciting method, we have a fantastic guest here today. Dr. Christina Chung is a specialist in stable isotope analysis. She received her PhD from the University of British Columbia and is currently a postdoctoral researcher at the Vrije Universiteit Brussel, where she is working on the European Research Council's Lumiere project. In the last decade, she's worked on a wide variety of places and times: Roman Britain, the earliest Neolithic of Iran, the Bronze Age of China, and more specifically, the people living at the Shang capital of Yinju, and now Neolithic France as well. Dr. Chung, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me. I'm very happy to be here.
So what got you interested in bioarchaeology in general and stable isotope analysis in particular in the first place?
So I've always been interested in history, and I also really enjoy working in the lab. So when I discovered that bioarchaeology is a thing, I just jumped right into it. But before I started specializing in stable isotope analysis, I did spend some time trying out different other techniques. So I worked with starch analysis, I did some radiocarbon dating, and I also spent 1 year in an ancient DNA lab in Copenhagen before I started my PhD. And I'm not saying that these other techniques are not as interesting or as useful, but I mean, they're all really cool and tells you very different aspects of people's lives in the past. And so in the beginning, when I need to choose something to specialize, which you do have to choose something, it was really a matter of chance that I get to work on the Roman British site. Several Roman British sites in the UK. But the more I learn about the method, the more I really enjoy working with it. And I think that to me, there's something really special and personal about stable isotope analysis. It is about someone's lifetimes and about their choices and, you know, their movements, their way of lives. So, I mean, unlike DNA, which is also very personal, but it tend to be about something that's more bigger. It's multi-generations. It's something you inherited. But isotopes tells you something that you acquired over your lifetime. So it's something that is kind of, in terms of scale, it is smaller, but more intimate. And also, I love food. and I'm sure everybody does. And I'm really intrigued by diets and food. And I suppose having lived in many countries and having met friends from many different backgrounds and, you know, eating with them and learning about the preferences, it really got me thinking how our diets reflect or even to a certain extent define who we are. And so everybody has to eat, and it is a survival instinct. But on the other hand, it's both universal and individual. Like, what we eat and how we eat, it depends on so many factors, like, you know, economic status, religion, or personal preferences. So I think stable isotope analysis is a way into these very intimate parts of lives in the past. And then I think it's really neat that we're able to do that.
Yeah, that's so cool. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that 25 or 30 years ago, I mean, I think I was starting to do history and archaeology maybe 15 years ago, people figured that you kind of had to leave questions like this aside. What did people living in prehistoric societies eat? Well, okay, maybe you can get some animal bones out of a site. Maybe, maybe you can pull some kind of micro remains and see, okay, there's grasses there. But the idea that you can actually look at somebody's bones and sample them and see what the contents of their diets were, how that changed over the course of their life. That's a really incredible thing to be able to come into that kind of intimate contact, as you put it, with somebody who lived 5,000 years ago, 8,000 years ago, 10,000 years ago. That's an incredible thing.
Yeah, and depends on the type of food and the type of baseline you have. It's even possible to quantify. So not just like what this person ate, but how much of this thing that this person ate. And so you can compare, say like you ate more beef than I do. Like, you know, this is something that, again, it's very cool that you can now compare two groups of people into very specific ways.
So let's talk about stable isotopes in general. Which isotopes can be analyzed, and what can the different isotopes that you can analyze tell us?
So isotopes are different versions of the same element, but with slightly different mass or weight. So for example, carbon-12 and carbon-13 are both carbon, but carbon-13 has one more neutron than carbon-12, so it will be slightly heavier, but chemically they are the same thing. So stable carbon isotope and stable isotope analysis measures the ratios of two different stable isotopes in something. So in the case of stable carbon isotope analysis, we would look at the ratio of carbon-13 relative to carbon-12. And in the natural world, elements in an environment may have different stable isotope ratios due to many reasons that I won't go into details here, but these different ratios or this different stable isotope signature will be incorporated into the organism. So whether it be humans or animals or plants, through processes like respiration or digestion, this signature incorporated in the organism. So then in theory, an organism should have the corresponding isotopic signature that reflects their local environment or the food that they ate. And based on this principle, by looking at the isotopic signature of a person, we should be able to reverse engineer this data and infer information about this person's life, like where they grew up, what they ate, or something like that. So for example, people living by the ocean, if they eat a lot of seafood, they would have different isotopic signatures than people who grew up on top of a mountain, or, you know, people who are mostly vegetarian. So there are many elements or many isotope systems you can exploit. And in archaeology, the most commonly used isotope systems are the one I just mentioned, carbon, and also nitrogen, sulfur, oxygen, strontium, and lead. But there are more and more systems coming up in recent years. So, for example, there's calcium, there's zinc and copper. But I would like to focus on the more common ones for now. So in the very, very general sense, carbon and nitrogen isotopes are primarily related to diet. They come from your food. And so the stable isotope ratios of carbon and nitrogen would mostly inform the source of your dietary protein. So again, as I said, whether you ate a lot of seafood or whether you are, you know, eat a lot of meat, a meat lover, or, you know, mostly vegetarian or even a vegan. And the other isotope systems are more related to mobility. So sulfur, strontium, and lead are mostly related to the underlying geology or even the level of pollution in the local environment. And then oxygen is mostly related to the climate. So it will tell you about, this distance from the ocean, whether it's cold, hot, dry, or humid. So depending on your question and also what material is available to you, you can choose which isotope systems you want to explore.
So that's incredible. So you can ask and answer a ton of different questions about a person's lived experience on the basis of those isotopes. That's really cool. I mean, so that's an incredibly flexible set of tools to have available to you. And I feel like your career, you've worked on a ton of different times and places, and you've shown just how flexible that toolkit can be. You've worked on Roman Britain, you've worked on Bronze Age China, you're working on the Neolithic now. I thought it was so funny as I was looking through your body of work that I realized that I had assigned a paper that you worked on Roman Britain to undergrad students in a class that I taught like 7 years ago. And I used the paper that you worked on Ganj Dare in Iran when I wrote about that site last year for this show. So how have you ended up working on so many different times and places? Do some of them resonate more with you than others? Do you feel differently about them?
Thank you so much. You're too kind. The Roman one was one of my first studies. So that's it's always special because it's my baby. But I have been extremely lucky to, you know, have the opportunity to work on so many extraordinary sites and projects. And yeah, and you're absolutely right, just because the technique is so versatile and flexible, and also because eating is such a universal thing, you can't, you know, avoid eating. So this technique is applicable on really any sites or any period you want. The only problem is that obviously we can't be an expert in all the sites you ever work on. So it's really important to work closely with the local archaeologists, to rely on their many years of experience to better understand our data. But speaking of what sites that Renaissance more with me, I would say very recently I was lucky to be involved with a very, very tiny data set from Hong Kong. It's very special to me because I'm from Hong Kong, and this is really the first isotopic study done there. And this paper just got accepted like in last year in November, and it should come out anytime now. But the quick summary is a very small data set, 10 individuals from the late Neolithic period. But it shows that back in the Neolithic period, Hong Kong people were extreme fish eaters, and they were eating lots of large fish and even marine mammals like dolphins and porpoises. And their isotopic values were comparable to seal hunters in the Arctic Circle. So that's very surprising, because most of us would assume that Neolithic people would be, especially in the subtropical area where you can farm, that they would be eating more terrestrial resources. But turns out they were extreme, as I said, really, really extreme fish eaters. I really like find it's cool is that because my parents and their family, being originally from a very small fishing village nearby, they're still obsessed with seafood. We have a WhatsApp chain with my family, and like seriously, photos are consisting mostly of the seafood they either they bought about to cook or the seafood they're eating. And my friends here do make fun of me about that. and so it's really neat to see that there's our connection to the ocean is still there. And obviously I'm not trying to claim that, you know, there's an unbroken tradition for over 3,000 years, but I'm sure things were more complicated in between, but I'm just really excited about this finding.
No, that is really, really, really cool. I wish I had known about that paper, because one of the things I wanted to talk about but didn't feel like I had enough evidence to discuss was kind of variation in the late Neolithic in China. So I ended up focusing when I did a few episodes on the Yellow River area, but like I would have loved mm-hmm. to have talked more about the rest of China. That is fascinating. That's really, really, really cool.
It should come out maybe, I hope, next week, because yeah, it has been accepted for 2 months now.
Oh, okay. Well, so I'm working on a book on prehistory more generally, and now I really want to use that study to talk about kind of foodways in the late Neolithic. That's awesome. Okay, so let's keep going talking about China. One of the things that you've worked on the most is you wrote your doctoral dissertation on people who were buried in the cemeteries at Yinzhou. That's also known as mm-hmm. Anyang. That was the last capital of the Shang Dynasty. And not just that city, but also the surrounding settlements. So what kind of analysis did you perform on these people, and what did it tell you about Yinzhou and the Shang more generally?
So for that project, initially when I started at UBC, there was a project that a professor there, Dr. Jing Jichun, he just wrote out this project to try to solve the question about sacrificial victims found at the site. So he was hoping that I could come in and help him with answering that question. So I just want to give a little, you know, some very brief background. But basically, Yinzhou, as you said, is the last capital of the Shang Dynasty. And it is the place where the first evidence of writing in East Asia were discovered. So basically, it makes it so that it's kind of the beginning of historical period in China. And so the site was in use for about 200 years between 1250 to 1046 BC. And then one thing that's really astonishing and the site is the mass scale sacrificial rituals. And some of these involved animals, but many more involved humans. And so based on both archaeological excavations as well as oracle bone inscriptions, there were approximately 13,000 humans sacrificed over 200 years in Yinzhou and obviously and also animals. So most of the sacrificial victims were mutilated. In some ways, many were decapitated. And when the remains were good enough for sexing and well-preserved enough for sexing and aging, a vast majority of them were adult males. There were some women and children, but they were not found very often. So it's a very specific demography that they're targeting. So obviously, this is a very interesting question. Where did they get their sacrificial humans? Like, were they from somewhere else or were they local? Which I don't think anybody thought they were local because there were just too many of them. So to answer the question whether they're local or not, you want to know the mobility patterns of them. But traditionally, you tend to use oxygen and strontium isotopes to assess mobility. But then strontium isotopes can only be analyzed in the enamel because of contamination issues. And as I mentioned, many of these individuals were mutilated. So the group of sacrificial victims that they selected for me to start with happened to be headless. So they don't have any heads. There are no teeth. I can't really do strontium. So luckily I convinced Dr. Jing to let me still try with just carbon nitrogen just to, you know, have a start. And he agreed.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
To begin with, I just started with carbon nitrogen and I tested. He selected some samples for me from a group of sacrificial victims and also a group of local residents, and so I can compare them. And very lucky for me, they were very different. They were two distinct clusters. They had very different diet. So that's kind of promising, but it doesn't tell as much about mobility. So I spoke with Jing and Dr. Mike Richards, who was my PhD supervisor, and then they decided that I should go take more samples and try sulfur isotope analysis. So sulfur is also measured in bone collagen. It doesn't have to be in a teeth or something. So then it's something you can measure alongside carbon and nitrogen. But the issue is that because there are a lot less sulfur in bone, and so you need a lot more material. So I need to get more samples. And so I went to Anyang and then saw that someone already tried to take samples from the femur for DNA analysis. So I was like, oh, why not? Femurs are usually very well preserved. I'll take some samples from the femur. And so I did. And I remember this is kind of a funny story, because when Jane gave me the first batch of samples, they're not from femurs, they're from various smaller bones from the hand, from the arms. So they're not very well preserved. So I got back to Vancouver with the femur, I extracted the collagen, and I thought I might as well measure carbon nitrogen as well. So this way I will have carbon nitrogen sulfur from the same extraction instead of from two different extractions. And I remember distinctively that I prepared all the collagen for measurements and I flew to Switzerland for a conference with some colleagues. And I was supposed to present the preliminary results of this study. But the day before my presentation, I received data from a lab manager. And to my horror, all of the femur values were consistently off from the other values.
Oh, no.
So I was terrified. I thought, because they're all from the same individuals, just from different bones. And I initially thought, oh, I must have done something wrong in the lab. There must be something wrong with the extraction, or, you know, it's an instrumental shift. And so basically, like, I was terrified. And so I went back to Vancouver and we extracted all the samples, the femurs and the smaller hand bones, arm bones, and just everything, and reanalyzed them. And the results came back. It turns out that I didn't mess anything up. These people, they actually had different values in isotopic values in their femurs and their other bones. So what, this mean
what's the cause of that?
Yeah, so that meant that they likely had a change of diet during a lifetime.
Oh.
Yeah, so there's something called turnover rate. So different tissues in our body have different turnover time. So turnover times refers to how long it would take for the tissues to be completely renewed. So bigger bones like femurs that is very dense, they tend to turn over very slow or even never, depending on your age and your metabolism rate. And smaller bones like ribs, they turn over a lot quicker. So in adults, femurs would retain several decades of dietary record, while the smaller bones would record the last 3 or so years of their life.
That is so interesting. So in the same individual, you can track changes in diet over the course of a life. That is incredible.
Yeah. So it's not like I haven't really thought of using this technique because I honestly didn't think it would work. They have done it with, for example, Richard III in the UK, and it's really, they compare different elements. And yeah, it's fascinating. And there's also dentin. Like if you have teeth, you can also look at dentin, because dentin, once formed, they never remodel. So it would represent the earliest record, but again, I don't have teeth, so I can't do that. So yeah, so the femur values should more or less represent their original dietary signal, where the isotope values from the other smaller bones should represent basically the dietary signal from the last few years of their life.
And how did those differ?
So it's a little annoying that I can't show you the figure, but I will try to describe it verbally. So if you plot the data on a graph, you will see that the insulocals are on the left and then the sacrificial victims are on the right, forming two distinct clusters. And then among the sacrificial victims, you can see that the femur values are on the furthest right, so away from the local, where the smaller bone values are somewhere in the middle between the local and the femur values. The sulfur shows similar pattern. So carbon, nitrogen, and sulfur all show a similar pattern. Mm-hmm.
So these were people who grew up somewhere else. They were where they were eating a completely different diet. Then they were eventually brought to Yinshu, where they were eating a diet that was more similar to that of the locals, but still not identical with it. And then they died.
Yeah. So the important thing is that they actually had to live there for several years, because they need time for that signature to register in their bones. So it's not like they got brought in and killed immediately. They were brought there, lived for a few years, ate the local food. And then I can't say for sure that the food they ate was the same or not, because there could be some mixing going on. It takes time to mix, but it definitely they have spent some time in Inshu before being killed.
So as you were working on this, not to take it too far from the realm of, you know, kind of strict science, but what were you thinking and feeling as you were working with these people's remains?
To be honest, I was very excited because I was young and I didn't really think about the fact that they were humans and being sacrificed. But then when I first started, the samples were brought to me by Jing. And so I only see the little pieces of bones and you know, when you when it is removed from the actual skeleton, you don't really think about it as a human. So I lied a little bit about not having any teeth. So these individuals, they were decapitated from the back. And so the thing is, they must have really, really sharp blades to cut these to decapitate them. Because so for a few of the individuals, there are 30 of them in this particular set, a few of them, the blade actually cut through the mandible, so the lower jaw. Mm-hmm. And so because of how when they died, there was still soft tissue. And so they must have basically cut through the mouth. And so the lower jaw was attached to the body. So I do have a few teeth. Mm-hmm. But once I saw that part, and you know, you can kind of imagine the process, and then I do feel, oh, this is terrible. Mm-hmm.
It's one of the things that's kind of, I feel like having done a little work on the Sheng now, that's kind of hard to think about just the sheer scale of it. Because you mentioned it's 13,000 people, and it seems to be really central to the way that they're organizing the world, that human sacrifice seems to be a really foundational part of the way that they're mm-hmm. organizing their world. And in the way that they talk about it, they seem to not see these people as belonging to a different category than livestock. And so it's kind of hard to square that. It must be, at least when you're looking at the human remains, and then you've got, when you have evidence for the perspective of how they were seen and treated, I don't know exactly what I'm getting at, but there seems to be a kind of a disconnect there that must be kind of hard to wrap your head around.
Yeah, and there are also different levels of sacrificial humans. Like, there are these ones that are mutilated in a mass grave, but then they are not like thrown in half-heartedly. They were placed in very orderly. So, for example, these headless individuals, there were 10 in each pit, and they were stacked in 5 layers. So two on in one layer, and then the two on top, but in opposite direction. And so it's very well organized, but they were mutilated for sure, and obviously like brutally murdered. And then there are some slightly kind of still sacrificed humans, but you can see they were treated slightly better. Like they have their own pit. And then there are some that were just skulls. There were some skull pits as well. But these are the one that we call the human offerings. And then there are the human companions, which usually they are buried with some sort of weapons. They have seems like they have a role in life. You know what I mean? They're buried with a chariot with horses. They were probably drivers. And then with this category, it's a very hierarchical society in both life and death.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So having done all of this analysis, what do you think it tells you about how the Sheng understood the world, how the Sheng ran things, and about the city itself in which these people were living?
So actually, for me, I feel like my research actually, you know, provide more questions than answers. So based on my isotopic analysis, it shows, yes, these individuals, they were not locals, which is not really surprising for anyone. But what is kind of surprising is that, so I need to go back to explaining the premise of this, what were the hypotheses about these sacrificial victims. So according to the oracle bone inscriptions, vast majority of these sacrificial humans were from a group called Chang. And for example, in one instance, there were 900 Chang people were sacrificed in one single ceremony. But nobody knows who were the Chang people. And there are many hypotheses. One, like kind of more, the milder ones are that it's just generally a general terms for all enemies. But then most people quite strongly believe that they actually refer to a very specific group of enemies from in the West. And because the word Chang, if you can see it, it has two little sheep horns on it. So the speculations are that they were pastoralists, so sheep herders from the West, and that these sacrificial victims were war captives from this particular group. And there are even speculations that the Siwa culture in Gansu province, so very, very far west, that they were the Chang people. And so if they are pastoralist, then you would expect the sacrificial victims to show isotopic values that are more comparable to pastoralist. So for my PhD, I also asked for some samples from different groups, including from Siwa culture, who were known pastoralists who, you know, living in the West, and then just to compare with. And our sacrificial humans shows that, and not just from one context, it's from for my PhD, I have samples from three separate contexts, but also there's another study that came out quite recently that looked at the isotopic compositions of sacrificial victims from a different, basically not in the royal cemetery, but in another royal tomb. And then all of these sacrificial victims from Yinxi I've seen so far, none of them have isotopic values that are typical of pastoralists. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. They were all millet farmers.
I see. Okay. That's really interesting. And one of the things that I really appreciated about your work in general, as I was working on this, was that this makes these people human. like the work that you've done on them gives them kind of gives them their humanity back in some way, shape, or form. Because it's really easy to talk about the scale of human sacrifice and to talk about what this meant for the Shang in their world. But when you're talking about the kinds of foods that they ate and the arc of their life that starts somewhere else and then involves spending a few years at Yinju before their sacrifice, like that makes them much more human in a way that I really appreciated as I was working on this.
Thanks. Yeah. And I think there was definitely an effort to make the Chang people sound uncivilized or even barbaric, you know, just to present them as an ultimate symbol of enemy. And this is 100% political propaganda. But the million-dollar question is it old propaganda or is it, you know, later propaganda from later historical period? Because this is something not just archaeologists are talking about now, but it has been discussed throughout the, I don't know, the historical period, like who were the Chang people? Because the Chang people has always been depicted as this, you know, very barbaric tribes in the West.
Mm-hmm. So if it turns out that they're just neighboring millet farmers, then that gives you a much different perspective on the Shang and what they were up to.
Yeah, but then part of me was because, okay, so several years ago, I gave a talk in Queen's University, Belfast, and then the title of my talk was Oracle Bones, the World's First Political Propaganda. And now looking back, that was a little sensationalist because if the Oracle Bones, like they were supposed to be prayers to the god, like I'm not sure if the scriptors would willingly write down wrong information to mislead the gods. Like maybe someone lied to them or, you know, who knows, or maybe Chang in the Shang context did not mean barbaric sheep herders. It might mean something else that we misinterpreted over the years.
Something I thought was really interesting in a recent book, the archaeologist Roderick Campbell wrote about that. Mm. And I think his argument was that in the context of the Oracle Bones, it takes on kind of a general meaning where it means kind of to be driven. So the sheep horns on the sign, that's connected to the connotation of the people being driven in the same manner as livestock.
Yeah, that's another interpretation. And unfortunately, this is not something stable isotope analysis can answer. but I do think that I'm just throwing in fodder to more discussion because they clearly, there's something doesn't add up. These people clearly are not barbaric. Well, they're not sheep herders. They are millet farmers. And like, think about it, like it would be quite not sustainable to have to bring in war captives from so far away consistently. Mm-hmm. It makes more sense that they were from closer area.
And that tells you something really interesting about the boundaries of the Shang world and how they made them, right? That if these are people who aren't coming from that far away, that when it comes to drawing boundaries between who's inside and outside, it's not necessarily a matter of distance. These could be people who lived quite close. So that's a really interesting thing.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of the hunt. But are you getting the thrill of the best deals? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Urban Outfitters, Fenty Beauty, and Expedia. And even stack sales on top of cash back. It's easy to use and you get your cash back through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
One of the things that seems to be a kind of a hallmark of your work across all these different periods is that you use really, really big samples. So there are 379 people in your doctoral dissertation. In the paper on diet and climate change that you did that I want to ask about in a little while, you used more than 1,000 people from 53 different sites. What are the benefits of larger sample sizes when it comes to isotopic analysis?
Yes. So obviously for any scientific research, bigger sample size is always better because then you have more statistical power. But then that's not always possible in archaeology because we are kind of limited to work with what we can find. For example, one problem with a study I mentioned in Hong Kong is that we only have 10 individuals. that's the only remains we could find. And then the problem with that is that they're really, really cool data, but I can't say if they're outliers or not because they're just 10 and there are nothing else in the area, like in the vicinity of Hong Kong. There's just because preservation in Southeast Asia is just terrible. The soil is very acidic. So you don't have just human bones in general. So you just have this 10 data points and you don't know how normal this is. And so with bigger data sets, then you can kind of better identify what is normal and what's not. And I think that's the way to go in moving forward is that we need to, if whenever possible, have bigger data sets. And I'm not saying that means that you have to personally analyze more samples because it's not always feasible. You know, we always have funding constraints and stuff like that. So one way to do it is the paper you mentioned about the climate change is that I actually didn't have any original data from myself. They are all from previously published reports. And just because, you know, there are basically, I think it's safe to say there are tens of thousands of isotopic data being generated every year. And this is this huge, you know, wealth of resources that we need to make use of and exploit.
So is there anything like a kind of a centralized database that handles all of this? Or if you wanted to go out and do another project like that one, where like this climate change paper, I've now mentioned it a couple of times, but basically you found that there was a sudden shift in diet in China between 2500 and 2000 BC. You found this by looking at 1,000 samples from 50 different sites. And you mentioned that it was all previously published data. Is there any kind of central repository of that? Or for something like that paper, do you have to go and comb through the samples and put it all together yourself?
I'm so glad you mentioned this. So yeah, for that paper, I had to comb through, and not just me, because it was looking at isotope data and also dental health data. Mm-hmm. So my colleague had to comb through dental studies, and then I had to comb through isotope studies, and it took us almost 1 year to do that. And then it was very time consuming, and also some of the data is being, you know, hidden in not just behind paywalls, but like in very small journals or very small site reports that it's very difficult to get to. I have to make a lot of phone calls and like beg my colleagues in China to scan it for me or even just take a photo and send it to me. And it was very, so much work. And luckily, so there are actually some isotope archives popping up in the last couple of years. So one of it that I want to mention, well, I think I will mention all of them, but then one particularly is a colleague of mine, Kevin Salas. He has started the ISOARC initiative. So it is an open access archive. You can deposit your isotope data and it's free for everyone to use. So I have dumped all of data I collected for that climate change paper, but I included more because for the climate change paper, I only have Northern and Northwest China. And over the years, I also collated more samples from other parts of Asia. So I have this like 3,000 isotope data points and from East and Northeast Asia. And so I've like dumped all of them in ISOARC. So then now anybody who wants to look at isotopic data from Asia, they will be able to find it a lot easier. And then all the references are there. They have been cross-checked by people at ISOARC, so they're, you know, trustworthy. And currently, so this database is not just focusing on Asia. Currently, most of the data in ISOARC are actually from Europe. But they also have increasingly more and more data sets from South America and South Pacific. Obviously, not all the data will be useful to everyone, but this way we can make sure people won't have to suffer like I did when I did that climate change paper. And we can maximize the use of these data, which is very, very important because, mm-hmm. you know, archaeological samples, they are non-renewable resources. Mm-hmm. And we want to maximize them.
Yeah, well, that's so fascinating. And it's something I talked about this with Stephen Shannon, who's done a lot of work on, especially like radiocarbon dating, but on big data in archaeology in general. And one of the things that he was talking about was that one of the new problems is that you've got all of this archaeoscience in all of these different fields that's doing incredible work. So isotopes and ancient DNA and in radiocarbon mm-hmm. dating. But now the problem is not just generating the data, it's collating it and finding ways to analyze it. And that's an entirely different challenge than just going out and doing the samples. Like, that's an entirely different kind of thing to have to figure out.
Yeah, so I think in order to really able to maximize now, like, we have so many isotope data, like, to be able to really fully exploit this, we have to begin to learn about programming, to do modeling, statistical modeling. And this is something new that, unfortunately, a lot of archaeologists are not very comfortable with, because it's a complete new world. And I understand, because I struggle a lot with that. But then that's the beauty of being able to collaborate with people who are good at that. So yeah, there are ways around it.
It's one of the really cool things about watching archaeology develop, because I was trained as a historian, and history is still very much like an individual field. You know, you go out mm-hmm. and you formulate your questions and you do your research and you write your thing. But in watching archaeology, it's like it has always been a more collaborative field, and watching it mm-hmm. become like much, much more collaborative, that allows you to do dramatically cooler stuff. I wish more historians did that, frankly, like found cool people to work with where you can answer bigger questions. Like that's one of the really cool things about watching archaeologists work, I think.
I mean, I work with historians as well, because Shang Dynasty is basically a historical period, and I'm intrigued by history. So I have met a lot of historians. It's just that at least in China, unfortunately, that you don't get a lot of funding into doing historical archaeology. So isotopes mm-hmm. still, you know, cost a bit more money than mm-hmm. than other research. So yeah, so but I expect to see more and more collaboration between everyone.
So as you're kind of sitting at this moment, you're doing the work that you're doing right now, what excites you about the future of it? Are there things that you want to work on? Are there more tools that you'd like to develop or approaches that you want to try?
I mean, there are always things I want to learn, probably too many. So one main thing that I want to learn now is that, so now I am a postdoc on the Lumiere project in Belgium here. And so this lab is basically famous, known for analyzing strontium isotopes in cremated remains. So this is something that I've never done before. So I've done some strontium isotope analysis, but I have never worked with cremated remains. And so it is really cool, because like before the method was developed in 2014 and 15, no one can really do much about cremated remains other than just looking at a few pieces that are still relatively intact. But now the door has opened to do chemical analysis on cremated remains. And so I think this is something that will allow so many more questions to be answered. And also right now, cremated, there's not a lot of labs that can do that. And so one of my really selfish wishes is that if I learned it, I want to bring this to Hong Kong, because again, I want to do archaeology in Hong Kong. And then I know we have a lot of cremated remains that no one has been able to do anything with it. And it will be cool to do that.
That would be really awesome. Well, having read through a whole bunch of your work, it really is cool. The implications of it are amazing. And I cannot wait to see what you do moving forward. Dr. Chung, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. And I hope we get to chat again.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Tides of History ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey. Thanks so much for joining me today. Be sure and hit me up if you'd like to chat about anything we've talked about on Tides or something you'd like to see. You can find me on Twitter at Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at @PatrickWymanMMA or on Instagram at @Wyman_Patrick. I write on other topics at patrickwyman.substack.com. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Morgan Jaffe. From Wondery, the executive producers are Jenny Lower-Beckman and Marshall Louie. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
If you travel for work, you know to pack two suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know business.